Leopold Tallheart had his turn the following day. He spoke of weather portents and the slack wits of small folk, and told how his nephew itched for battle.
Benfred has raised his own company of lancers, boys, none older than 19 years, but everyone thinks he's another young wolf. When I told them they were only young rabbits, they laughed at me. Now they call themselves the Wild Hares and gallop about the country with rabbit skins tied to the ends of their lances, singing songs of chivalry.
Bran thought that sounded grand. He remembered Benfred Tallheart, a big, bluff, loud boy who had often visited Winterfell with his father, Sir Helman, and had been friendly with Rob and with Theon Greyjoy. But Sir Roderick was clearly displeased by what he heard. If the king were in need of more men, he would send for them, he said. Instruct your nephew that he is to remain at Torrhen Square, as his lord father commanded.
I will, sir, said Leopold, and only then raised the matter of Lady Hornwood. Poor thing, with no husband to defend her lands, no son to inherit. His own lady wife was a Hornwood, sister to the late Lord Hallis, doubtless they recalled. An empty hall is a sad one. I had a thought to send my younger son to Lady Danella to foster as her own. Baron is near 10, a likely lad, and her own nephew. He would cheer her, I'm certain, and perhaps he would even take the name Hornwood.
If he were named heir, suggested Maester Lewin.
So the house might continue, finished Leopold.
Bran knew what to say. Thank you for the notion, my lord, he blurted out before Sir Roderick could speak. We will bring the matter to my brother Rob. Oh, and Lady Hornwood. Leopold seemed surprised that he had spoken.
I'm grateful, my prince, he said.
But Bran could see pity in his pale blue eyes, mingled perhaps with a little gladness that the cripple was, after all, not his son. For a moment, he hated the man. Maester Lewin liked him better, though.
Baron Tallheart may well be our best answer, he told them when Leopold had gone. By blood, he is half Hornwood. If he takes his uncle's name, he will still be a boy, said Sir Roderick, and hard-pressed to hold his lands against the likes of Mors Umber or this bastard of Bruce Bolton's. We must think on this carefully. Rob should have our best counsel before he makes his decision.
It may come down to practicalities, said Maester Lewin, which lord he most needs to court. The Riverlands are part of his realm. He may wish to cement the alliance by wedding Lady Hornwood to one of the lords of the Trident. A Blackwood, perhaps, or a Frey.
Lady Hornwood can have one of our Freys, said Bran. She can have both of them if she likes.
You are not kind, my prince, Sir Roderick chided gently.
Neither are the Walders. Scowling, Bran stared down at the table and said nothing. In the days that followed, ravens arrived from other lordly houses bearing regrets. The bastard of the dread fort would not be joining them. The Mormonts and Carstarks had all gone south with Rob. Lord Locke was too old to dare the journey. Lady Flint was heavy with child. There was sickness at Widow's Watch. Finally, all of the principal vassals of House Stark had been heard from, save for Harlan Reed, the Crannock man, who had not set foot outside his swamps for many a year, and the Serwins, whose castle lay half a day's ride from Winterfell. Lord Serwin was a captive of the Lannisters, but his son, a lad of 14, arrived one bright, blustery morning at the head of 24 lancers. Bran was riding Dancer around the yard when they came through the gate. He trotted over to greet them. Clay Serwin had always been a friend to Bran and his brothers. Good morning, Bran, Clay called out cheerfully. Or must I call you Prince Bran now? Only if you want, Clay laughed. Why not? Everyone else is a king or prince these days.
Did Stannis write Winterfell as well?
Stannis? I don't know.
He's a king now, too, Clay confided. He says Queen Cersei bedded her brother, so Joffrey is a bastard.
Joffrey the Illborn, one of the Serwyn knights growled. Small wonder he's faithless, with a Kingslayer for a father.
Aye, said another. The guards ate incest. Look how they brought down the Targaryens.
For a moment, Bran felt as though he could not breathe. A giant hand was crushing his chest. He felt as though he was falling and clutched desperately at Dancer's reins. His terror must have shown on his face.
Bran, Clay Serwyn said, are you unwell? It's only another king.
Rob will beat him too.
He turned Dancer's head toward the stables, oblivious to the puzzled stares the Serwyns gave him. His blood was roaring in his ears, and had he not been strapped onto the saddle, he might well have fallen. That night, Bran prayed to his father's gods for dreamless sleep. If the gods heard, they mocked his hopes, for the nightmare they sent was worse than any wolf dream.
Fly or die,
cried the three-eyed crow as it pecked at him. He wept and pleaded, but the crow had no pity. It put out his left eye and then his right. And when he was blind in the dark, it pecked at his brow, driving its terrible sharp beak deep into his skull. He screamed until he was certain his lungs must burst. The pain was an axe splitting his head apart. But when the crow wrenched out its beak, all slimy with bits of bone and brain, Bran could see again. What he saw made him gasp in fear. He was clinging to a tower miles high, and his fingers were slipping, nails scrabbling at the stone, his legs dragging him down, stupid, useless, dead legs.
Help me, he cried.
A golden man appeared in the sky above him and pulled him up. The things I do for love, he murmured softly, as he tossed him out, kicking into empty air. Tyrion.
I do not sleep as I did when I was younger, Grand Maester Pycelle told him, by way of apology for the dawn meeting. I would sooner be up, though the world be dark, than lie restless abed, fretting on tasks undone, he said, though his heavy-lidded eyes made him look half asleep as he said it. In the airy chambers beneath the rookery, his girl served them boiled eggs, stewed plums, and porridge, while Pycelle served the pontifications.
In these sad times, when so many hunger, I think it only fitting to keep my table spare.
Commendable, Tyrion admitted, breaking a large brown egg that reminded him unduly of the Grand Maester's bald, spotted head. I take a different view. If there is food, I eat it, in case there's none on the morrow, he smiled. Tell me, are your ravens early risers as well?
Pycelle stroked the snowy beard that flowed down his chest.
To be sure. Shall I send for quill and ink after we have eaten?
No need.
Tyrion laid the letters on the table beside his porridge, twin parchments tightly rolled and sealed with wax at both ends.
Send your girl away so we can talk. Leave us, child, Pycelle commanded.
The serving girl hurried from the room.
These letters now. For the eyes of Doran Martell, Prince of Dawn.
Tyrion peeled the crack shell away from his egg and took a bite. It wanted salt.
One letter in two copies. Send your swiftest birds. The matter is of great import.
I shall dispatch them as soon as we have broken our fast.
Dispatch them now. Stewed plums will keep. The realm may not.
Lord Renly is leading his host up the Rose Road, and no one can say when Lord Stannis will sail from Dragonstone.
Pycelle blinked. If my lord prefers. He does.
I am here to serve. The maester pushed himself ponderously to his feet, his chain of office clinking softly. It was a heavy thing, a dozen maester's collars threaded around and through each other and ornamented with gemstones. And it seemed to Tyrion that the gold and silver and platinum links far outnumbered those of baser metals. Pycelle moved so slowly that Tyrion had time to finish his egg and taste the plums, overcooked and watery to his taste, before the sound of wings prompted him to rise. He spied the raven, dark in the dawn sky, and turned briskly toward the maze of shelves at the far end of the room. The maester's medicines made an impressive display. Dozens of pots sealed with wax, hundreds of stoppered vials, as many milk glass bottles, countless jars of dried herbs, each container neatly labeled in Pycelle's precise hand. An orderly mind, Tyrion reflected, and indeed, once you had puzzled out the arrangement, it was easy to see that every potion had its place. And such interesting things. He noted sweet sleep and nightshade, milk of the poppy, the tears of lice, powdered grey cap, wolfsbane, and demon's dance. Basilisk venom, blind eye, widow's blood. Standing on his toes and straining upward, he managed to pull a small dusty bottle off the high shelf. When he read the label, he smiled and slipped it up his sleeve. He was back at the table, peeling another egg, when Grand Maester Pycelle came creeping down the stairs.
It is done, my lord, the old man seated himself. A matter like this, best done promptly. Indeed. Indeed. Of great import, you say? Oh, yes.
The porridge was too thick, Tyrion felt, and wanted butter and honey. To be sure, butter and honey were seldom seen in King's Landing of late, though Lord Giles kept them well supplied in the castle. Half of the food they ate these days came from his lands, or Lady Tander's. Rosby and Stokeworth lay near the city to the north, and were yet untouched by war.
The Prince of Dawn himself. Might I ask, best not? As you say.
Pycelle's curiosity was so ripe that Tyrion could almost taste it.
Mayhaps the King's Council?
Tyrion tapped his wooden spoon against the edge of the bowl. The Council exists to advise the King, Maester.
Just so, said Pycelle. And the King is a boy of 13. I speak with his voice. So you do, indeed. The King's own hand. Yet, your most gracious sister, our Queen Regent, she bears a great weight upon those lovely white shoulders of hers. I have no wish to add to her burdens. Do you?
Tyrion cocked his head and gave the Grand Maester an inquiring stare. Pycelle dropped his gaze back to his food. Something about Tyrion's mismatched green and black eyes made men squirm. Knowing that, he made good use of them.
Ah, the old man muttered into his plums. Doubtless you have the right of it, my lord. It is most considerate of you to spare her this burden.
That's just the sort of fellow I am, Tyrion returned to his unsatisfactory porridge.
Considerate. Cersei is my own sweet sister, after all. And a woman, to be sure, Grandmaster Pycelle said. A most uncommon woman, and yet it is no small thing to tend to all the cares of the realm, despite the frailty of her sex.
Oh, yes, she's a frail dove. Just ask Eddard Stark.
I'm pleased to share my concern. I thank you for the hospitality of your table, but a long day awaits.
He swung his legs out and clambered down from his chair.
Be so good as to inform me at once, should we receive a reply from Dawn. As you say, my lord. And only me. To be sure.
Bicel's spotted hand was clutching at his beard the way a drowning man clutches for a rope. It made Tyrion's heart glad. One, he thought. He waddled out into the lower bailey. His stunted legs complained of the steps. The sun was well up now, and the castle was stirring. Guardsmen walked the walls, and knights and men-at-arms were training with blunted weapons. Nearby, Bronn sat on the lip of a well. A pair of comely serving girls sauntered past, carrying a wicker basket of rushes between them. But the sellsword never looked. Bronn, I despair of you, Tyrion gestured at the wenches. With sweet sights like that before you, all you see is a gaggle of louts raising a clangor. There are 100 whorehouses in this city where a clip cooper will buy me all the cunt I want, Bronn answered. But one day my life may hang on how close I've watched your louts. He stood. Who's the boy in the checkered blue surcoat with the three eyes on his shield? Some edge knight. Tallard, he names himself. Why?
Bronn pushed a fall of hair from his eyes.
He's the best of them, but watch him. He falls into a rhythm, delivering the same strokes in the same order each time he attacks. He grinned. That will be the death of him the day he faces me.
He's pledged to Joffrey. He's not like to face you.
They set off across the bailey, Bronn matching his long stride to Tyrion's short one. These days the sellsword was looking almost respectable. His dark hair was washed and brushed, he was freshly shaved, and he wore the black breastplate of an officer of the city watch. From his shoulders trailed a cloak of Lannister crimson patterned with gold hands. Tyrion had made him a gift of it when he named him captain of his personal guard.
How many supplicants do we have today? He inquired.
30-odd, answered Bronn. Most with complaints or wanting something as ever. Your pet was back. He groaned. Lady Tander? Her page. She invites you to sup with her again. There's to be a haunch of venison, she says, a brace of stuffed geese, sauce with mulberries, and her daughter.
Tyrion finished sourly. Since the hour he had arrived in the Red Keep, Lady Tender had been stalking him, armed with a never-ending arsenal of lamprey pies, wild boars, and savory cream stews. Somehow she had gotten the notion that a dwarf lordling would be the perfect consort for her daughter Lollys, a large, soft, dim-witted girl who rumor said was still a maid at 33.
Send her my regrets. No taste for stuffed goose, Bronn grinned evilly. Perhaps you should eat the goose and marry the maid, or better still, send Shagger.
Shagger's more like to eat the maid and marry the goose, observed Bronn. Anyway, Lollys outweighs him.
There is that, Tyrion admitted as they passed under the shadow of a covered walkway between two towers. Who else wants me?
The sellsword grew more serious. There's a moneylender from Braavos, holding fancy papers and the like. Request to see the king about payment on some loan. As if Joff could count past 20. Send the man to Littlefinger. He'll find a way to put him off. Next. A lordling down from the Trident says your father's men burned his keep, raped his wife, and killed all his peasants.
I believe they call that war.
Tyrion smelled Gregor Clegane's work, or that of Sir Aemery Lorch, or his father's other pet hellhound, the Cohorric. What does he want of Joffrey? New peasants, Bronn said. He walked all this way to sing how loyal he is and beg for recompense. I'll make time for him on the morrow. Whether truly loyal or merely desperate, a compliant river lord might have his uses. See that he is given a comfortable chamber and a hot meal. Send him a new pair of boots as well, good ones, courtesy of King Joffrey. A show of generosity never hurt. Bronn gave a curt nod. There's also a great gaggle of bakers, butchers, and greengrocers clamoring to be heard. I told them last time I have nothing to give them. Only a thin trickle of food was coming into King's Landing, most of it earmarked for castle and garrison. Prices had risen sickeningly high on greens, roots, flour, and fruit, and Tyrion did not want to think about what sorts of flesh might be going into the kettles of the pot shops down in Flea Bottom. Fish, he hoped. They still had the river and the sea, at least until Lord Stannis sailed. They want protection. Last night, a baker was roasted in his own oven. The mob claimed he charged too much for bread. Did he? He's not apt to deny it. They didn't eat him, did they? Not that I've heard. Next time they will, Tyrion said grimly. I give them what protection I can. The gold cloaks. They claim there are gold cloaks in the mob, Bronn said. They're demanding to speak to the king himself. Tch, fools. Tyrion had sent them off with regrets. His nephew would send them off with whips and spears. He was half tempted to allow it. But no, he dare not. Soon or late, some enemy would march on King's Landing, and the last thing he wanted was willing traitors within the city walls. Tell them King Joffrey shares their fears and would do all he can for them. They want bread, not promises. If I give them bread today, on the morrow, I'll have twice as many at the gates. Who else? A black brother down from the wall. The steward says he brought some rotted and in a jar. Tyrion smiled wanly. I'm surprised no one ate it. I suppose I ought to see him. It's not Yoren, perchance. No, some knight, Sir Alistair Thorne? Of all the black brothers he'd met on the wall, Tyrion Lannister had liked Sir Alistair Thorne the least. A bitter, mean-spirited man, with too great a sense of his own worth. Come to think of it, I don't believe I care to see Sir Alistair just now. Find him a snug sill where no one has changed the rushes in a year, and let his hand rot a little more. Bronn snorted laughter and went his way, while Tyrion struggled up the serpentine steps. As he limped across the outer yard, he heard the portcullis rattling up. His sister and a large party were waiting by the main gate. Mounted on her white palfrey, Cersei towered high above him, a goddess in green. Brother, she called out, not warmly. The queen had not been pleased by the way he'd dealt with Jaina Slint. Your grace, Tyrion bowed politely, you look lovely this morning. Her crown was gold, her cloak ermine. Her retinue sat their mounts behind her. Sir Boris Blunt of the King's Guard, wearing white scale and his favourite scowl. Sir Balon Swan, bowslung from his silver inlay saddle. Lord Giles Rusby, his wheezing cough worse than ever. Halin, the pyromancer of the Alchemist Guild. And the Queen's newest favourite, their cousin, Sir Lancel Lannister, her late husband's squire, up jumped tonight at the widow's insistence. Valar and 20 guardsmen rode escort. Where are you bound this day, sister? Tyrion asked. I'm making a round of the gates to inspect all the new scorpions and spitfires. I would not have it thought that all of us are as indifferent to the city's defences as you seem to be. Cersei fixed him with those clear green eyes of hers, beautiful even in their contempt. I am informed that Renly Baratheon has marched from Highgarden. He's making his way up the Rose Road with all his strength behind him. Varys gave me the same report. He could be here by the full moon. Not at his present leisurely pace, Tyrion assured her. He feasts every night in a different castle, and holds court at every crossroad he passes. And every day more men rally to his banners. His host is now said to be 100,000 strong. That seems rather high,
He has the power of Storm's End and High Garden behind him, you little fool.
Cersei snapped on at him.
All the Tyrell bannermen, but for the Red Wines, and you have me to thank for that. So long as I hold those poxy twins of his, Lord Paxter will squat on the arbor and count himself fortunate to be out of it. A pity you let the native flower slip through your pretty fingers. Still, Renly has other concerns besides us. Our father at Heddon Hall, Robb Stark at River Run. Were I he, I would do much as he is doing.
Make my progress, flaunt my power for the realm to see. Watch, wait. Let my rivals contend while I bide my own sweet time. If Stark defeats us, the South will fall into Renly's hands like a windfall from the gods, and he'll not have lost a man. And if it goes the other way, he can descend on us while we are weakened.
Cersei was not appeased.
I want you to make Father bring his army to King's Landing.
Well, it will serve no purpose but to make you feel safe.
When have I ever been able to make Father do anything?
She ignored the question.
And when do you plan to free Jaime? He's worth 100 of you.
Tyrion grinned crookedly.
Don't tell Lady Stark, I beg you. We don't have 100 of me to trade.
Father must have been mad to send you. You're worse than useless. The queen jerked on her reins and wheeled her palfrey around. She rode out of the gate at a brisk trot, ermine cloak streaming behind her. Her retinue hastened after.
In truth, Renly Baratheon did not frighten Tyrion half as much as his brother Stannis did. Renly was beloved of the commons, but he had never before led men in war. Stannis was otherwise, hard, cold, inexorable. If only he had some way of knowing what was happening at Dragonstone. But not one of the fisherfolk he had paid to spy out the island had ever returned, and even the informers the eunuch claimed to have placed in Stannis' household had been ominously silent. The striped hulls of Lycian war galleys had been seen offshore, though, and Varys had reports from Myr of sail captains taking service with Dragonstone. If Stannis attacks by sea while his brother Renly storms the gates, they'll soon be mounting Joffrey's head on a spike. Worse, mine will be beside him.
A depressing thought. You ought to make plans to get Shae safely out of the city should the worst seem likely.
Podrick Payne stood at the door of his solar, studying the floor.
He's inside, he announced to Tyrion's belt buckle.
Your solar, my lord. Sorry.
Tyrion sighed. Look at me, Pod. It unnerves me when you talk to my codpiece, especially when I'm not wearing one. Who is inside my solar?
Lord Littlefinger.
Podrick managed a quick look at his face, then hastily dropped his eyes.
I meant Lord Pataya, Lord Baelish, the Master of Coin.
You make him sound a crowd. The boy hunched down as if struck, making Tyrion feel absurdly guilty.
Lord Pataya was seated on his window seat, languid and elegant, in a plush plum-coloured doublet and a yellow satin cape, one gloved hand resting on his knee.
The king is fighting hares with a crossbow, he said. The hares are winning. Come, see.
Tyrion had to stand on his toes to get a look. A dead hare lay on the ground below. Another, long ears twitching, was about to expire from the bolt in his side. Spent quarrels lay strewn across the hard-packed earth like straw scattered by a storm.
Now, Joff shouted. The gamesman released the hare he was holding, and he went bounding off. Joffrey jerked the trigger on the crossbow, the bolt missed by 2 feet.
The hare stood on his hind legs and twitched his nose at the king. Cursing, Joff spun the wheel to winch back his string, but the animal was gone before he was loaded.
Another!
The gamesman reached into the hutch. This one made a brown streak against the stone, while Joffrey's hurried shot almost took Sir Preston in the groin. Littlefinger turned away. "Boy, are you fond of potted hair?" he asked Podrick Payne. Pod stared at the visitor's boots, lovely things of red-dyed leather ornamented with black scrollwork. "To eat, my lord." "Invest in pots," Littlefinger advised. "Hares will soon overrun the castle. We'll be eating hare thrice a day."
"Better than rats on a skewer," said Tyrion. "Pod, leave us, unless Lord Pataya would care for some refreshment."
"Thank you, but no."
Littlefinger flashed his mocking smile.
"Drink with a dwarf its head, and you wake up walking the wall. Black brings out my unhealthy pallor."
"Have no fear, my lord," thought Tyrion. "It's not the wall I have in mind for you."
He seated himself in a high chair piled with cushions and said, "You look very elegant today, my lord." "I am wounded. I strive to look elegant every day."
"Is the doublet new?"
"It is, or most observant."
"Plum and yellow. Are those the colors of your house?"
"No, but a man gets bored wearing the same colors day in and day out, or so I've found."
"That's a handsome knife as well."
"Is it?"
There was mischief in Littlefinger's eyes. He drew the knife and glanced at it casually, as if he had never seen it before.
"Valyrian steel and a dragonbone hilt. A trifle plain, though. It's yours, if you would like it."
"Mine?" Tyrion gave him a long look.
"No, I think not. Never mine."
"He knows, the insolent wretch. He knows, and he knows that I know, and he thinks that I cannot touch him."
If ever truly a man had armored himself in gold, it was Pataya Baelish, not Jaime Lannister. Jaime's famous armor was but gilded steel, but Littlefinger's... Tyrion had learned a few things about sweet Pataya to his growing disquiet. 10 years ago, John Aaron had given him a minor sinecure in customs, where Lord Pataya had soon distinguished himself by bringing in 3 times as much as any of the king's other collectors. King Robert had been a prodigious spender. A man like Pataya Baelish, who had a gift for rubbing 2 gold dragons together to breed a third, was invaluable to his hand. Littlefinger's rise had been arrow swift. Within 3 years of his coming to court, he was master of coin and a member of the small council. And today, the crown's revenues were 10 times what they had been under his beleaguered predecessor, though the crown's debts had grown vast as well. A master juggler was Pataya Baelish. Oh, he was clever. He did not simply collect the gold and lock it in a treasure vault, no. He paid the king's debts in promises and put the king's gold to work. He bought wagons, shops, ships, houses. He bought grain when it was plentiful and sold bread when it was scarce. He bought wool from the north and linen from the south and lace from Lice, stored it, moved it, dyed it, sold it. The golden dragons bred and multiplied, and Littlefinger lent them out and brought them home with hatchlings. And in the process, he moved his own men into place. The keepers of the keys were his, all 4. The king's counter and the king's scales were men he'd named. The officers in charge of all 3 mints, harbor masters, tax farmers, customs sergeants, wool factors, toll collectors, pursers, wine factors, 9 of every 10 belonged to Littlefinger. They were men of middling birth, by and large, merchants' sons, lesser lordlings, sometimes even foreigners, but judging from their results, far more able than their high-born predecessors. No one had ever thought to question the appointments, and why should they? Littlefinger was no threat to anyone. A clever, smiling, genial man, everyone's friend.
always able to find whatever gold the king or his hand required, and yet of such undistinguished birth, one step up from a hedge knight, that he was not a man to fear. He had no banners to call, no army of retainers, no great stronghold, no holdings to speak of, no prospects of a great marriage. But do I dare touch him? Tyrion wondered, even if he is a traitor. He was not at all certain he could, least of all now, while the war raged. Given time, he could replace Littlefinger's men with his own in key positions, but a shout rang up from the yard. "Ah, his grace has killed a hare," Lord Baelish observed. "No doubt a slow one," Tyrion said. "My lord, you are fostered at River Run. I've heard it said that you grew close to the Tullys."
"You might say so. The girls especially."
"How close?"
"I had their maidenheads. Is that close enough?"
The lie, Tyrion was fairly certain it was a lie, was delivered with such an air of nonchalance that one could almost believe it. Could it have been Catelyn Stark who lied about her defloration and the dagger as well? The longer he lived, the more Tyrion realized that nothing was simple and little was true. "Lord Astor's daughters do not love me," he confessed. "I doubt they would listen to any proposal I might make. Yet coming from you, the same words might fall more sweetly on their ears."
"That would depend on the words. If you mean to offer Sansa in return for your brother, waste someone else's time. Joffrey will never surrender his plaything, and Lady Catelyn is not so great a fool as to barter the Kingslayer for a slip of a girl. I mean to have Arya as well. I have men searching. Searching is not finding.
I'll keep that in mind, my lord. In any case, it was Lady Lysa I hoped you might sway. For her, I have a sweeter offer."
"Lysa is more tractable than Catelyn, true, but also more fearful. And I understand she hates you."
"She believes she has a good reason. When I was her guest at the Eyrie, she insisted that I'd murdered her husband and was not inclined to listen to denials." He leaned forward. "If I gave her John Aaron's true killer, she might think more kindly of me."
That made Littlefinger sit up. "True killer? I confess. You make me curious. Who do you propose?" It was Tyrion's turn to smile.
"Gifts I give my friends freely. Lysa Arryn would need to understand that."
"Is it her friendship you require, or her swords?"
"Both." Littlefinger stroked the neat spike of his beard.
"Lysa has woes of her own. Clansmen raiding out of the Mountains of the Moon in greater numbers than ever before, and better armed."
"Distressing," said Tyrion Lannister, who had armed them. "I could help her with that. A word from me."
"And what would that word cost her?"
"I want Lady Lysa and her son to acclaim Joffrey as king, to swear fealty, and to
make war on the Starks and Tullys."
Littlefinger shook his head.
"There's the roach in your pudding, Lannister. Lysa will never send her knights against River Run."
"Nor would I ask it. We have no lack of enemies. I'll use her power to oppose Lord Renly or Lord Stannis, should he stir from Dragonstone. In return, I will give her justice for John Aaron and peace in the Vale. I will even name that appalling child of hers Warden of the East, as his father was before him."
"I want to see him fly,"
a boy's voice whispered faintly in memory. "And to seal the bargain, I will give her my niece."
He had the pleasure of seeing a look of genuine surprise in Petyr Baelish's grey-green eyes.
"Marcella?"
"When she comes of age, she can wed little Lord Robert. Until such time, she'll be Lady Lysa's ward at the Eyrie."
And what does Her Grace the Queen think of this ploy? When Tyrion shrugged, Littlefinger burst into laughter. I thought not. You're a dangerous little man, Lannister. Yes, I could sing this song to Lysa. Again the sly smile, the mischief in his glance. If I cared to. Tyrion nodded, waiting, knowing Littlefinger could never abide a long silence. So, Lord Petar continued after a pause, utterly unabashed, what's in your pot for me?
Arranal?
It was interesting to watch his face. Lord Petar's father had been the smallest of small lords, his grandfather a landless hedge knight. By birth, he held no more than a few stony acres on the windswept shore of the Fingers. Harrenhal was one of the richest plums in the Seven Kingdoms, its lands broad and rich and fertile, its great castle as formidable as any in the realm, and so large as to dwarf River Run, where Petar Baelish had been fostered by House Tully, only to be brusquely expelled when he dared raise his sights to Lord Hoster's daughter. Littlefinger took a moment to adjust the drape of his cape, but Tyrion had seen the flash of hunger in those sly cat's eyes.
I have him, he knew.
Harrenhal is cursed, Lord Petar said after a moment, trying to sound bored. Then raise it to the ground and build anew to suit yourself. You'll have no luck of coin. I mean to make you liege lord of the Trident. These river lords have proven they cannot be trusted. Let them do you fealty for their lands. Even the Tullys, if there are any Tullys left when we are done. Littlefinger looked like a boy who had just taken a furtive bite from a honeycomb. He was trying to watch for bees, but the honey was so sweet. Harrenhal and all its lands and incomes, he mused. With a stroke, you'd make me one of the greatest lords in the realm. Not that I'm ungrateful, my lord, but, why? You serve my sister well in the matter of the succession, as did Jaina Slint, on whom this same castle of Harrenhal was quite recently bestowed, only to be snatched away when he was no longer of use. Tyrion laughed.
You have me, my lord, what can I say? I need you to deliver the Lady Lysa. I did not need Jaina Slint. He gave a crooked shrug. I'd sooner have you seated in Arranal than Renly seated on the Iron Throne. What could be plainer?
What indeed? You realize that I may need to bed Lysa Arran again to get her consent to this marriage?
I have little doubt you'll be equal to the task.
I once told Ned Stark that when you find yourself naked with an ugly woman, the only thing to do is close your eyes and get on with it.
Littlefinger steepled his fingers and gazed into Tyrion's mismatched eyes.
Give me a fortnight to conclude my affairs and arrange for a ship to carry me to Gulltown.
That will do nicely.
His guest rose. This has been quite the pleasant morning, Lannister, and profitable. For both of us, I trust.
He bowed, his cape a swirl of yellow, as he strode out the door.
Two, thought Tyrion.
He went up to his bedchamber to await Varys, who would soon be making an appearance. Evenfall, he guessed. Perhaps as late as moonrise, though he hoped not. He hoped to visit Shay tonight. He was pleasantly surprised when Galt of the Stone Crows informed him, not an hour later, that the powdered man was at his door.
You are a cruel man to make the Grand Maester squirm so, the eunuch scolded. The man cannot abide a secret.
Is that a crow I hear, calling the raven black? Or would you sooner not hear what I proposed to Doran Martell?
Varys giggled.
Perhaps my little birds have told me. Have they indeed? He wanted to hear this. Go on. The Dornish men have thus far held aloof from these walls. Doran Martell has called his banners, but no more. His hatred for House Lannister is well known, and it is commonly thought he will join Lord Renly. You wish to dissuade him? All this is obvious, said Tyrion. The only puzzle is what you might have offered for his allegiance. The prince is a sentimental man, and he still mourns his sister Ilya and her sweet babe. My father once told me that a lord never lets sentiment get in the way of ambition, and it happens we have an empty seat on the small council now that Lord Janus has taken the black.
A council seat is not to be despised, Varys admitted. Yet will it be enough to make a proud man forget his sister's murder?
Why forget? Tyrion smiled. I promise to deliver his sister's killers, alive or dead, as he prefers, after the war is done, to be sure.
Varys gave him a shrewd look.
My little birds tell me that Princess Ilya cried a certain name when they came for her. Is a secret still a secret if everyone knows it? In Casterly Rock, it was common knowledge that Gregor Clegane had killed Ilya and her babe. They said he had raped the princess with her son's blood and brains still on his hands. This secret is your lord father's sworn man. My father would be the first to tell you that 50,000 Dornish men are worth one rabid dog. Varys stroked a powdered cheek. And if Prince Doran demands the blood of the lord who gave the command, as well as the knight who did the deed, Robert Baratheon led the rebellion. All commands came from him in the end. Robert was not at King's Landing. Neither was Doran Martell. So, blood for his pride, a chair for his ambition. Golden land, that goes without saying. A sweet offer, yet sweets can be poisoned. If I were the prince, something more would I require before I should reach for this honeycomb. Some token of good faith, some sure safeguard against betrayal. Varys smiled his slimiest smile. Which one will you give him, I wonder? Tyrion sighed. You know, don't you? Since you put it that way, yes, Tommen. You could scarcely offer Missella to Doran Martell and Lysa Arryn both. Remind me never to play these guessing games with you again. You cheat. Prince Tommen is a good boy. If I pry him away from Cersei and Joffrey while he's still young, he might even grow to be a good man. And a good king. Joffrey is king, and Tommen is heir, should anything ill befall his grace. Tommen, whose nature is so sweet and notably tractable. You have a suspicious mind, Varys. I shall take that as a tribute, my lord. In any case, Prince Doran would hardly be insensible of the great honor you do him. Very deftly done, I would say. But for one small flaw. The dwarf laughed. Named Cersei? What avails statecraft against the love of a mother for the sweet fruit of her womb? Perhaps for the glory of her house and the safety of the realm, the queen might be persuaded to send away Tommen or Missella, but both of them surely not.
What Cersei does not know will never hurt me.
And if Her Grace were to discover your intentions before your plans are ripe...
Why, he said, then I would know the man who told her to be my certain enemy. And when Varys giggled, he thought, three.
Sansa. Come to the Guardswood tonight, if you want to go home. The words were the same on the 100th reading as they had been on the first, when Sansa had discovered the folded sheet of parchment beneath her pillow. She did not know how it had gotten there, or who had sent it. The note was unsigned, unsealed, and the hand unfamiliar. She crushed the parchment to her chest and whispered the words to herself. Come to the Guardswood tonight, if you want to go home. She breathed ever so faintly. What could it mean? Should she take it to the Queen, to prove she was being good? Nervously, she rubbed her stomach. The angry purple bruise Sir Meron had given her had faded to an ugly yellow, but still hurt. His fists had been mailed when he hit her. It was her own fault. She must learn to hide her feelings better, so as not to anger Joffrey. When she heard that the imp had sent Lord Slint to the wall, she had forgotten herself and said, Oh, I hope the others get him. The king had not been pleased. Come to the Guardswood tonight if you want to go home. Sansa had prayed so hard. Could this be her answer at last? A true knight sent to save her? Perhaps it was one of the Redwine twins, or bold Sir Balon Swan, or even Beric Dondarrion, the young lord her friend Jane Poole had loved, with his red-gold hair and the spray of stars on his black cloak. Come to the Guardswood tonight, if you want to go home. What if it was some cruel jape of Joffrey's, like the day he'd taken her up to the battlements to show her father's head? Or perhaps it was some subtle snare to prove she was not loyal. If she went to the Guardswood, would she find Sir Ilyan Payne waiting for her, sitting silent under the heart tree, with ice in his hand, his pale eyes watching to see if she'd come? Come to the Guardswood tonight if you want to go home. When the door opened, she hurriedly stuffed the note under her sheet and sat on it. It was her bedmaid, the mousy one with the limp brown hair. What do you want? Sansa demanded.
Will my lady be wanting a bath tonight?
A fire, I think. I feel a chill. She was shivering, though the day had been hot.
As you wish.
Sansa watched the girl suspiciously. Had she seen the note? Had she put it under the pillow? It did not seem likely. She seemed a stupid girl, not one you'd want delivering secret notes. But Sansa did not know her. The Queen had her servants changed every fortnight to make certain none of them befriended her. When a fire was blazing in the hearth, Sansa thanked the maid curtly and ordered her out. The girl was quick to obey as ever, but Sansa decided that there was something sly about her eyes. Doubtless she was scurrying off to report to the Queen, or maybe Varys. All her maids spied on her, she was certain. Once alone, she thrust the note into the flames, watching the parchment curl and blacken. Come to the Guardswood tonight if you want to go home. She drifted to her window. Below, she could see a short knight in moon-pale armor and a heavy white cloak pacing the drawbridge. From his height, it could only be Sir Preston Greenfield. The Queen had given her freedom of the castle, but even so, he would want to know where she was going if she tried to leave Maegor's Holdfast at this time of night. What was she to tell him? Suddenly, she was glad she had burned the note. She unlaced her gown and crawled into her bed, but she did not sleep. Was he still there, she wondered? How long will he wait? It was so cruel to send a note and tell her nothing.
The thoughts went round and round in her head. If only she had someone to tell her what to do. She missed Scepter Mordane, and even more, Jane Poole, her truest friend. The Scepter had lost her head with the rest for the crime of serving House Stark. Sansa did not know what had happened to Jane, who had disappeared from her rooms afterward, never to be mentioned again. She tried not to think of them too often, yet sometimes the memories came unbidden, and then it was hard to hold back the tears. Once in a while, Sansa even missed her sister. By now, Arya was safe back in Winterfell, dancing and sewing, playing with Bran and baby Rickon, even riding through the winter town if she liked. Sansa was allowed to go riding too, but only in the Bailey, and it got boring going round in a circle all day. She was wide awake when she heard the shouting, distant at first, then growing louder. Many voices yelling together. She could not make out words. And there were horses as well, and pounding feet, shouts of command. She crept to her window and saw men running on the walls, carrying spears and torches. "Go back to your bed," Sansa told herself. "This is nothing that concerns you, just some new trouble out in the city." The talk at the wells had all been of troubles in the city of late. People were crowding in, running from the war, and many had no way to live save by robbing and killing each other. Go to bed. But when she looked, the white knight was gone. The bridge across the dry moat, down, but undefended. Sansa turned away without thinking and ran to her wardrobe. "What am I doing?" she asked herself as she dressed. "This is madness." She could see the lights of many torches on the curtain walls. Had Stannis and Renly come at last to kill Joffrey and claim their brother's throne? If so, the guards would raise the drawbridge, cutting off Maegor's holdfast from the outer castle. Sansa threw a plain grey cloak over her shoulders and picked up the knife she used to cut her meat. "If it is some trap, better that I die than let them hurt me more," she told herself. She hid the blade under her cloak. A column of red-cloaked swordsmen ran past as she slipped out into the night. She waited until they were well past before she darted across the undefended drawbridge. In the yard, men were buckling on sword belts and cinching the saddles of their horses. She glimpsed Sir Preston near the stables with three others of the King's Guard, white cloaks bright as a moon as they helped Joffrey into his armor. Her breath caught in her throat when she saw the king. Thankfully, he did not see her. He was shouting for his sword and crossbow. The noise receded as she moved deeper into the castle, never daring to look back for fear that Joffrey might be watching, or worse, following. The serpentine steps twisted ahead, striped by bars of flickering light from the narrow windows above. Sansa was panting by the time she reached the top. She ran down a shadowy colonnade and pressed herself against a wall to catch her breath. When something brushed against her leg, she almost jumped out of her skin. But it was only a cat, a ragged black tom with a chewed-off ear. The creature spit at her and leapt away. By the time she reached the Godswood, the noises had faded to a faint rattle of steel and a distant shouting. Sansa pulled her cloak tighter. The air was rich with the smells of earth and leaf. Lady would have liked this place, she thought. There was something wild about a Godswood, even here, in the heart of the castle, at the heart of the city. You could feel the old guards watching with a thousand unseen eyes. Sansa had favored her mother's guards over her father's. She loved the statues, the pictures in leaded glass, the fragrance of burning incense, the septons with their robes and crystals, the magical play of the rainbows over altars inlaid with mother-of-pearl and onyx and lapis lazuli. Yet she could not deny that the Godswood had a certain power, too, especially by night. "Help me," she prayed. "Send me a friend, a true knight, to champion me." She moved from tree to tree, feeling the roughness of the bark beneath her fingers. Leaves brushed at her cheeks. Had she come too late?
he would not have left so soon, would he? Or had he even been here? Dare she risk calling out?